Mr. Lewin, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
This is your third trip up here on this case.
Yes. Yes, Your Honors. May it please the court. It is, of course, a fortuity that the court is hearing this case on the day before the President of the United States is scheduled to make a three-day trip to an area that the White House describes in its press release as a trip to Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan. Now, at the same time that the State Department is telling this court, as it does on page 4 of its brief, that it would critically compromise the ability of the United States to work with Israelis, Palestinians, and others in the region to further the peace process if there were any unilateral action by the United States that would signal symbolically or concretely that it recognizes that Jerusalem is a city that is located within the sovereign territory of Israel. At that very same time, the White House has issued a press release publicizing the trip to Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan, and listing an itinerary that is almost entirely within the city of Jerusalem. Meetings in Jerusalem with the President of Israel and Israel's Prime Minister, two overnight stays in the King David Hotel, a speech in the Jerusalem Convention Center, and visits to Mount Herzl, Yad Vashem, and the grave of former Prime Minister Rabin. It's hard to imagine any more symbolic and concrete official recognition of Jerusalem as being within Israel than the way the White House describes this trip by the President to prominent Jerusalem sites as a trip to Israel.
So do I read that as you conceding that that this is something you do have to show? That is, that for you to succeed here, you do have to show that the that 214 does not interfere with the President's recognition authority? Because your brief doesn't read that way. As I read your brief, you're arguing that, you know, the passport authority of Congress is sufficient. But now I hear you saying that you do have to show that.
Your Honor.
Right? Am I misreading your argument here?
Yes. Our point is there are a range of arguments, from the very broad one that affects separation of powers between Congress and the President, and who is it who would have ultimate authority over foreign policy. That is the broadest possible argument. Much narrower arguments supporting our position are that this is not an exercise of the power to recognize a foreign sovereign. But the very narrowest argument, and we urge that on the court because we know that the court, consistent with Supreme Court precedent, tries to avoid constitutional issues and take the narrowest ground that a case on which a case can be resolved. The narrowest ground is that this statute is no different than if it had been simply part of an overhaul of passport regulations over which Congress has plenary power. It's true
that Congress, when it passed this, Congress thought it was affecting recognition policy. The House Conference Report says this section contains four provisions related to the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That's what Congress thought it was doing.
Congress may have thought that that's what it was doing, but if there's anything that's demonstrated by the Chief Justice's opinion in the Affordable Care Act, which we have cited in our brief, it is that regardless of what Congress thought it was doing, it's up to the courts to determine whether the statute would be constitutional if it were put in a different category. If this statute were part of a passport act, I don't know whether we would be here, but I don't think that.
You mean you wouldn't be here because this wouldn't be a difficult issue? I actually don't see why that would make any difference.
Well, The only difference is that it has repeatedly been asserted by the government in its briefs, both in the district court, in this court, and in the Supreme Court, that this statute affects and impedes the president's authority with regard to foreign policy. There are many statutes that Congress enacts in its recognized authority over immigration, over international commerce, which may affect foreign policy, and yet the State Department and the Department of Justice and the president don't say, we're not going to enforce those
things. The argument here is not just, the president is not just invoking his foreign policy power, but the recognition authority granted to him in Article II, a specific provision of the Constitution. That's what he's relying on here.
We recognize that. Okay. Our position is that, the recognition power is not, as described by the government, one that has been exclusively the president's. And I don't want to take the full time I have for argument to go through the history. We've presented that in our briefs from the time of President Monroe, Presidents Jackson, Taylor, Lincoln, repeatedly in the early years, certainly, of the Republic, presidents indicated that they didn't think had the exclusive power.
I read your brief, and I think that that's a really interesting argument that you might want to present to the Supreme Court. But, you know, we're a lower court here, and we have Supreme Court cases which say pretty clearly things like political recognition is exclusively a function of the executive. Banco National. I mean, what do we do about that, this court?
Let me say first, Judge Atel, if that were true, if the Supreme Court were really standing by that proposition today, we would not be here. The Supreme Court instructed us.
What do we do as a lower federal court with language like that? President is sole organ in its external relations, Curtis Wright. I mean, how do we ignore language like that from the Supreme Court?
First of all, Judge Atel, that's only language. It is not the holding of the case. And there have been
many cases which say we are bound by considered Supreme Court dictum.
Well, again, I have several answers to that. First of all, if the Supreme Court today believed that was true, as I said, we would not be here. The Supreme Court asked us to argue the constitutional issue, which we did not present in our petition for certiorari. We argued it, and the court said no. Considering our arguments and the government's arguments, we want to hear from the Court of Appeals. So that is not.
The Supreme Court is not saying by telling you that they want to hear from us that we're free from Supreme Court precedent.
No,
we still have to decide this case under existing case law. And I mean, I understand your argument. I understand your argument that having a passport, say Israel, doesn't really affect the president's recognition power. I got that argument. That's an interesting argument that we should talk about. But I don't see how as a lower federal court we can deal with your other broader arguments about the president's constitutional authority.
Well, then let me retreat again in terms of your question, yeah. Judge Tatel, to the question that you say is more interesting to you. We've presented in our briefs, I think, the broader arguments, but as I say, there's a range. And with regard to the question of whether this implicates the recognition power at all, our position is nobody is saying that the president doesn't have the power to recognize Israel, to recognize Jordan, mm-hmm. to recognize a future Palestinian state if he does so, unless, again, one goes back to the history and says Congress could override that. But nobody is challenging that. The question is whether the statement that we will allow individuals who wish to identify themselves no differently from individuals who were born in Tel Aviv and Beersheba and Haifa as having been born in Israel, whether Congress could say to the president, yes, your State Department is wrong when it has prevented that, because it makes no sense. That's why my introduction.
But wait, why doesn't it make any sense? Let's talk about that. tell me why it doesn't make. I mean, the State Department's answer is, look, we have a very consistent policy. The policy is that what goes on a passport has to be accurate, and that means accurate in view of U.S. foreign policy. And they say that's the policy they've applied for decades. And why doesn't that make sense? And even if you don't think it makes sense, how can we second guess the president on that?
Well, let me say first, it's not I who is alone who is saying it makes no sense. It was the Congress by an overwhelming vote that said it made no sense. And it's the responsibility of the judiciary.
Well, now you want us to accept the congressional finding that this is about recognition.
Of
10 minutes ago, you told me we should ignore that.
No, in terms of the congressional finding, yeah. We stand totally behind the congressional finding that this particular policy makes no sense.
But
and I don't think it's
why.
My burden to prove it
to
makes no sense when Congress has said it makes no
but
sense.
But that's not the way we look at the case. The way we look at the case, our obligation is to ask whether the president's policy is so nonsensical that we can't defer to it. Now, obviously, one factor in that is what Congress thinks. I agree with you about that. But that clearly can't be dispositive. Otherwise, it would be eviscerating the president's recognition authority. So focus on the very specific policy for me that the president has articulated. Because I told you, it seems to me that's your strongest argument. But you have to tell me why it doesn't make sense other than Congress doesn't think it does. At least I think you have to tell me that.
It doesn't make sense because the view and the rule that Congress has imposed only means that there are an additional 50,000 American citizens who carry around a passport that says that they were born in Israel. It could not possibly affect foreign policy. Let me point up, if I might, the interesting thing is the case was in the Supreme Court. There was an enormous amount of publicity regarding it. There were amicus briefs, frankly, which supported our side. No Palestinian or Arab group submitted a brief in the Supreme Court or in this court. The only group that submitted an amicus brief opposing our position was a Jewish group, Peace Now, that said, okay, they thought that maybe this policy of the president should apply. But if, in fact, this was going to enrage the Palestinians so much that they would, as the State Department says, be up in arms over it and create a hubbub and enormous turmoil, why did we not see a single amicus brief on the other side?
So one of your arguments, then, is it doesn't make sense because the president hasn't shown and there, in fact, hasn't been any international disruptions or demonstrations or whatever because of the policy, right? That's one of your arguments.
Demonstrations or any real interest on the on the other side. Uh-huh. Nobody has said we're concerned about what appears in American passports. We're very troubled whether American citizens born in Jerusalem can say Israel in their passport if they so choose.
Do you think that's necessary? In other words, in order to intrude on the executive power, that there has to be a showing that there is a outrage in the Arab world?
Where Congress has held to the contrary, we think that's right. Where if we were here without a congressional statute, I can understand the argument that says it's up to the president and the State Department to decide it. But what this court is faced with is the fact that Congress has made a very deliberate decision that this policy makes no sense.
All right, let me ask you about that further then. How far would you go with that? In other words, if Congress thinks it's wrong for the executive branch to negotiate with a country or to something like that, can it go that far?
Here we come back when we deal with broad foreign policy questions to Justice Jackson's opinion in the Steele seizure case, which the Supreme Court in the Medellin case adopted and said, yes, this seems to be the correct standard. If we're speaking
with that, the problem with that is that did not Jackson's statement didn't come in the context of a situation where the president was invoking a power conferred on him by the Constitution, namely the recognition power. that's this case. And it doesn't seem to me that, I mean, your argument seems to be that we are entitled to conclude that the president's policy makes no sense when he's invoking a constitutional authority he's invoked it in a way that makes no sense because Congress says it makes no sense. I don't understand how that analysis fits into how we think about a conflict between a congressional statute and the president's invocation of a congressional authority. Basically what you're saying is that if Congress doesn't agree, then what the president's done is unconstitutional. And that can't be right, can it?
Well, again, Judge Tatel, I understand. That's our broadest argument.
Mr. Lewin, I'm prepared. It's Judge Tatel. That's my name.
I'm sorry?
My name is Tatel.
I'm sorry, Judge Tatel. I apologize.
Can we continue with this question? I told you when you started that I thought your argument that this really didn't affect the recognition power was an interesting, potentially compelling argument. And the only thing you've told me to support that is that you should prevail because Congress agrees with you. And I've said I don't think that's dispositive because I see the president as invoking a constitutional authority of his own. So I'm looking for something from you that explains why a court of appeals facing a situation where a president is invoking a constitutional authority in the area of foreign policy, how we can determine that that policy makes so little sense that we don't have to defer to it, and we can declare this, and we can require him to issue the passport. That's what I'm looking for from you.
Right. Judge Tatel, our position, and again, it's a narrower argument, but our position is that this does not involve the recognition power. The question of whether Jerusalem is within Israel for purposes of self-identification in a passport is not part of the president's recognition power, even if we were to assume that there is a recognition power, and even if we were to assume that it has some foreign policy significance. Nonetheless, the determination of whether an individual may identify him or herself as born in Israel in a passport is not one of the things that is included in the Constitution.
What do you do other than telling me I'm not bound by Supreme Court opinions with the court's decision in Pink?
I'm sorry, in the court's
Pink. The court's decision in Pink, which says that the recognition power includes the power to set policy for recognition.
Pink, I do come back to the fact that Pink was a case where Congress was in line with the president. The statement made in the Pink opinion by Justice Douglas was that in that case, given the situation in which the president was exercising a power that Congress did not disapprove of, yes, Justice Douglas used the broad language, which we say is not necessarily been approved by the Supreme Court, even though the court has repeated it. A Harvard Law School professor said about Justice Sutherland, who made this statement in the Curtis Wright opinion, that the fact that Justice Sutherland writes well doesn't mean that he thinks correctly. And the fact is there are broad statements that were made.
He's a Supreme Court justice, and what he writes in dictum is binding on us, even if well-written. Right?
I don't think this would be the first case in which this court has looked at Supreme Court opinions and said that some language in a Supreme Court opinion or in several Supreme Court opinions was overbroad and was dictum. Uh-huh. But that is only, again, Judge Tatel, in connection with our broadest argument, okay. I think. Uh-huh. If, in fact, the court were to accept the proposition that Congress was simply acting with regard to how people identify themselves in a passport, then I think those broad constitutional issues with regard to the president and the president's power to recognize foreign sovereigns would not be an issue in this case.
See, the president, his answer to that is, look, the passport is an official document issued by the United States to introduce people to other countries, and that for 60 years, or maybe even longer, the policy has been that designations of place of birth have to be accurate, accurate according to U.S. recognition policy. And so, once again, other than the fact that Congress doesn't agree with that, and that you personally think that it doesn't affect the recognition policy, how would we write a sentence in an opinion saying that that policy is irrational?
I submit
what
it
would, we
would
say?
Be the same yeah. as if the president had said at a time when passports stated to a passport holder, put in, so we'll put in a passport, your height, your weight, the color of your eyes, and the color of your hair. Uh-huh. That's supposed to be accurate. It's supposed to be correct.
Right.
And what would happen if the president would say, I will not accept green as the color of the eyes? Congress could say self-identification is how the person identifies him or herself. And that is, the State Department acknowledged with regard to that case, that's the purpose of that line in the passport. It's not a political statement. It is how we find an American citizen who is abroad and as to whom there may be some problem.
Yeah, and the president,
date of birth, place of birth.
The president responds, yes, it is for identification. And as you've pointed out, or someone did, I think it was the Anti-Defamation League in its brief, the manual says it's for purposes of identification. But the State Department's response is true, but it can have recognition consequences.
And our response to that is it will have no recognition consequence okay. because it does not say Jerusalem is in Israel. Uh-huh. It does not say Jerusalem, Israel. It says Israel. There are 100,000 American citizens who carry passports that say Israel because they're born in Tel Aviv or Haifa. And here will be 50,000 more American passports that will say Israel.
Do you think Congress could have made this mandatory?
Pardon?
Could Congress have made this mandatory? That is, instead of giving a choice, required all?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
could
that.
Could Congress have required that all passports issued to Americans in Jerusalem say born in Israel instead of making it a choice? Could they have made it mandatory?
Could they have made an across-the-board
yeah.
requirement that what? That
would that all, be constitutional?
That all passports say Israel?
All passports issued to Americans born in Jerusalem say born in Israel.
I think it would be constitutional. Okay. I think that would be part of passport regulation.
Could Congress pass a law recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel?
Judge Tatel, that is the ultimate, broadest possible issue that could be presented in a future, you know, it wouldn't be litigation because nobody would have standing to raise it. But nonetheless, that raises the question, which is the historical issue about the recognition power. Could Congress have done that? Could Congress have recognized Cuba? Could Congress have recognized Mexico? Could Congress have recognized Texas? Could Congress have recognized Buenos Aires? That's what the history raises issues about. All that we're saying in our brief is this is an issue. It is not a foregone conclusion. I think on the second time we were in this court, Judge Edwards wrote a very long opinion on the political question issue and then said, well, of course the president has this power. Well, when we went back to the history, because the Supreme Court told us mm-hmm. that they wanted to hear the constitutional issue, when we went back to the history, it was the history demonstrated that that was not clear, that that was not so true, and that in fact, and I think that's what led the Supreme Court to say, we won't decide this. We're going to send it back to the Court of Appeals to have the Court of Appeals look at that history and make some decision. And in fact, in answer to your question, the State Department has done what is, we submit, is clearly discriminatory. They have said, if you're born in Tel Aviv, and you don't like Israel, you can insist on having only Tel Aviv in your passport. Very unusual. A Palestinian born in Tel Aviv can eliminate Israel. On the other hand, someone who's born in Jerusalem, who is pro-Israel, who may be Jewish, and says, I want it to say Israel, is told, no, you may not. Although the fellow born in Tel Aviv is permitted to strike Israel out of his American passport.
It's not discriminatory if it just operates pursuant to a neutral State Department policy, which is what the State Department says. It says our rule is that it's got to be accurate. And it isn't. It is accurate for somebody born in an American born in Tel Aviv to have Israel on his passport, but it isn't accurate for an American born in Jerusalem to have Israel on his passport. That's their response.
Well, that brings me back, and maybe given that my red light has been on for some time, I should conclude at this point, but brings me back to my opening statement and the observation I made that Jerusalem to the world and amicus briefs, an amicus brief of the Zionist Organization of America establishes that to so many agencies of the federal government, Jerusalem is in Israel.
Yeah, one more question, Mr. Lewin, because I know your time's up. You know, this case is about the birth certificate also, right?
Correct.
But there's nothing in the briefs about that. Is the birth certificate, are we to look at that differently than the passport?
We have not made a separate issue of the birth certificate, Judge Teitel. We have acknowledged that the two can be treated together because Congress has treated them together. It is true there may be some difference, although I submit that if one accepts the State Department's position, it is the mere fact that in some way the State Department will officially allow its personnel to say somebody born in Jerusalem is born in Israel will have a terrific impact on the Palestinian world and on those and on possible peace negotiations. So if one accepts that argument, it applies to the birth certificate as well as to the passport. But certainly there's a difference in terms of practical implementation.
But to be more precise, just for purposes of how we think about the issues here, if we were to disagree with you about the passport provision, you're not telling us that there's a separate basis for sustaining the birth certificate visit, right? Because you don't argue that in your brief.
We have not argued that. Obviously, if the court draws some such distinction, it's the court that makes the difference. We have not argued that there's a difference between the passport and the birth certificate.
All right, Mr. Thank you. Lewin, no. Jeff Rogers has questions. I've got questions.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
One of the amici briefs argued that we should apply a doctrine of constitutional avoidance. Is that applicable here?
We think it is, because we think that there are several broad constitutional questions here, Judge Rogers, which are, one, separation of powers between the President and the Congress over foreign affairs. Second constitutional question, does the President have exclusive authority to recognize foreign sovereigns? We think the constitutional questions can be avoided if the court says we're not viewing this in terms of sovereign authority to recognize foreign sovereigns or foreign policy. We're simply viewing this as a passport regulation, and we think it's permissible.
So to do that, would the court have to basically analogize to the Affordable Care Act argument that you made, that we can ignore the plain language that Congress used where it says, foreign policy, and it's not talking about passports except in that one subsection?
Frankly, even before the Affordable Care Act decision, we argued to the Supreme Court, and we have citations in our brief, to cases in which the Supreme Court has said that you take each subsection of a statute and determine its constitutionality separately. Therefore, we said 214D is not governed by what the court may think of A or B or C or the title of Section 214. You just look at 214D, it talks about a passport, that's sufficient.
And so the title doesn't give you any indication as to what D is, what D's purpose is?
Well, the title, of course, gives you an indication as to what some congressman had in mind. But for purposes of judicial review and determining whether a statute is constitutional, there are, we submit, a number of cases that say that the other subsections don't control subsection D. Nonetheless, when the Affordable Care Act decision was issued, and when the Chief Justice wrote the opinion he did, in which he said that notwithstanding the fact that Congress didn't rely on the taxing power, if we can sustain it under Kroll and Benson, under the taxing power, we will sustain it. And he was the deciding vote to sustain that statute under the taxing power. Mm-hmm. That, to us, was additional evidence of what we had previously believed anyway. And therefore, this Court can, under the Affordable Care Act decision, we think, ignore the title of Section 214 and the first three provisions of Section 214.
All right. So the argument, I mean, on either side is that either we have to ignore the Secretary's interpretation of what is a significant affect on either the President's recognition power or foreign policy, or we have to ignore the context in which Congress was speaking and say, while it titled this section foreign policy, it was really only enacting, as one of the justices has suggested, a provision relating to passports.
Let me make one slight correction to that, yeah. Judge Rogers, which is, it's not a question of ignoring what the Secretary says is the impact on the recognition power. We say, ultimately, it's a broader argument, and maybe an argument that Judge Tatel does not accept, but it's a broader argument that even if it were to affect the recognition power in some way, the President does not have exclusive authority in terms of recognition, and even if it affects foreign policy, under Justice Jackson's three-part test in the Steele seizure case, Congress could override in this circumstance what the President or the Secretary of State believes.
And I mean, you can look at that history you cited in your brief and view it as a political compromise as distinct from acknowledgement of a non-exclusive power, if I can put it that way. And similarly, there are Supreme Court cases indicating that even as to passports, the President can sometimes override what Congress has authorized.
Well, let me take the last part of Your Honor's question first. With regard to passports, we think it is clear from all the Supreme Court's passport decisions, Hague and Agee, Zemel and Rusk, all the decisions, that the Court looked to see whether there was congressional authority. The notion that the President has some independent authority to issue passports when he likes, the Supreme Court has not agreed with that. They sustained what the Secretary of State did in Zemel and Rusk and in Hague and Agee because they said, yes, there is congressional authority for that. So we don't think that the President has unilateral power.
Not unilateral, but I thought the Court, what I'm trying to understand here is there's a general authorization, but now, in my hypothetical case, the President has said in a specific instance that, either in the terms the Secretary has argued in the brief, impermissibly intrudes, or this is a policy matter that resides in the executive, not in the...
It's hard to, in the specific instance of Zemel and Rusk and Hague and Agee, the question was whether the Secretary of State could refuse to allow travel to Cuba, or the Secretary of State could refuse to allow a particular individual American citizen to be traveling for interest.
So that
it's a specific case, mm-hmm. and the Supreme Court said he can do that because Congress authorized it. Here in this case, Congress took precisely the opposite view.
Did any of those
it said we're not authorizing the president.
Did any of those cases involve the recognition
power? Pardon?
Did any of those cases involve the recognition power?
No. Okay. No. No. We acknowledge there has been no case, not to our knowledge, and certainly not in the Supreme Court, not in the lower courts, where Congress and the president have clashed over the recognition power. But now to go to the first part of your question, Judge Rogers, it's not a political compromise. If one goes back to the very earliest treatises, to the Rawls Treatise on the Constitution, written in the 1820s, he says Congress could override that.
I know, but the argument is, well, there's been a gloss put on that early history, and the Supreme Court has arguably accepted that gloss when it has repeatedly referred to an exclusive recognition power residing in the president.
First of all, let me come back to what I guess I've said before, maybe unsuccessfully, that if that were true and the Supreme Court actually believed that, we wouldn't be here. The Supreme Court would have just...
Well, the argument is the Supreme Court decided it was going to decide the political issue question and just let a lower court, you know, address the statutory issue that you're trying to get us to address. And then the Supreme Court presumably would address that later.
But the Supreme Court asked us to argue that. That was not part of our petition. In other words, the Supreme Court said to us, please present the constitutional issue to us. And if the constitutional issue were as clear, Judge Rogers and Judge Tatel, as you say, we wouldn't be here. The Supreme Court would have said, look, this is what our decisions say. Goodbye. And we're sorry you lose, which is what Judge Edwards said initially before he saw the history. I don't know what he thinks about the history. Nobody saw the history then. So it's true. They sent the case back, but they sent the case back only after they went through the arguments and recited them in the Chief Justice's opinion, the arguments on both sides. So you can't say that the court agreed with Justice Sutherland in the Curtis Wright case or with Justice Douglas in the Pink case or with any of these decisions with broad language, because had they approved that broad language, as I say, we wouldn't be here. But I am here, and I thank the court for the extra time. Thank you.
Is it Karasbang? Is Karasbang?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question that I didn't ask Mr. Lewin because he's been up here so long. Is there a congressional authority allowing the judiciary to seize passports of criminals that we think might flee?
Is there, sorry, congressional authority allowing the
judiciary to do that?
Judiciary to seize passports? I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Okay. Of
course, here when we're talking about the passport, we're talking about its...
In the recognition power, I know. I'm just trying to get the scope of the passport power. Is there a congressional authority back in the good old days when if you did travel to a prohibited country, the government seized your passport? And Mr. Lewin touched on the case about travel to Cuba. But was there congressional authority, or is there still now congressional authority, that if you travel to a prohibited country, if there are any more left, the State Department can seize your passport, or is that something that the State Department does without congressional authority?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. Of course, when Congress started legislating in this area in, I believe, 1856, Congress recognized that the president had authority over passports, and the president had, in fact, been issuing passports since the earliest days of the country. Now, when we talk about travel, that really brings in Congress's power under the immigration power and the Foreign Commerce Clause to control what goes in and out of this country, whereas what we're talking about in this case is the passport as a diplomatic instrument, as a political document that is addressed to a foreign power, as the court said in Hague.
All right, then let me ask you this. If the State Department had in its FAM a prohibition against the designation of transgender as opposed to whatever male or female, and could Congress, in its passport power, say, no, it's up to the American citizen how to describe his or her gender?
Your Honor, I don't know. The Secretary would have to look at that case if it came up. But this court said in Shockman that the issuance of passports is left to the Secretary under presidential regulation, subject only to constitutional safeguards, and that even those constitutional safeguards need to be defined with cautious regard for the responsibility of the executive in the conduct of foreign affairs. So we are particularly where we're talking about the role of the passport as a communicative document, really within the president's authority over passports. Now, of course, plaintiff argues that this is merely some kind of self-identification that Congress has authorized. But here what we're talking about, as the court noted, is the official, what we put in official government documents, and request we put something in these official government documents that's inconsistent with the president's recognition.
Yeah, but you decision. See, the argument that Mr. Lewin makes is that, you know, the argument would have been very good if Congress had said the passport has to say Jerusalem, Israel. But it just says Israel. And his point is that, you know, two people showing up, one born in Jerusalem and one born in Tel Aviv, showing up at a passport control in Paris, their passports are going to both say born in Israel. Nobody's going to know anything other than that. There's no message sent by that passport. So I don't see how simply identifying Israel on here sends any, I don't see how that interferes with the president's recognition authority. He can still take the position that Jerusalem is not part of Israel, but the passport just says Israel, and no one knows who looks at it where the person was born, other than that they were born in Israel. What's the answer to that?
Yeah, our longstanding policy applied everywhere in the world is that we do not put sovereigns in passports that are inconsistent with the United States recognition policy.
I know, but you're arguing, I was responding to your argument that this statute interferes with the president's recognition authority. And I know it interferes with your policy, but why does it interfere with the recognition authority?
Well, Your Honor, it's understood by the president to interfere with recognition. Of course, that foreign policy determination is entitled to a great deal of deference.
Right, but deference it's also doesn't mean just, you know, we stamp it and say, fine. It has to make sense. And well, so what is it about putting, again, it's not Jerusalem, Israel. It's just Israel.
Well, as the record in this case shows, this would be seen as a reversal of United States recognition authority, that the world would interpret this, that's at J62, as an act of recognition. So this isn't just the president saying that. This is the evidence that the world does understand what we put in policies to be an act of recognition. And, of course,
and what in the record supports that? Is it your answers to the interrogatories?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the State Department looked at this, and they said, yes, even just writing Israel, it is going to be seen as a reversal of our policy.
But is there any evidence of that other than that the Secretary says so?
Well,
it's been 10 years or 12 years. Well, however long
it's been. And there's the Taiwan example. I know you explained it away, but there's that note making clear that there was no change in policy as to recognition.
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, these Taiwan and Jerusalem, these are very, very sensitive issues wherein the Secretary needs to be able to evaluate the situation on the ground. In this case, we saw that when Congress passed this statute, it was greeted by uproar in the Middle East. And in spite of the President making very clear in the signing statement that it did not change the United States recognition policy, there was that very strong reaction. Now, as to Taiwan, of course, this is another immensely complicated question that I don't pretend to be an expert in, but the State Department's Taiwan policy is consistent with the general policy of allowing U.S. citizens born abroad to list towns, cities, or geographic areas as the place of birth, and it does comport with the policy of not putting places of birth in passports that are inconsistent with United States recognition decisions. So the Taiwan example actually supports our position here. This, when we talk about putting Israel in the passport of somebody born in Jerusalem, that is putting a sovereign in the passport that the United States doesn't consider to be sovereign. This is just like somebody born in Latvia when, under the USSR, we never recognized the USSR's sovereignty over Latvia. So somebody born in Latvia couldn't put USSR.
No one challenged the constitutionality of that. I mean, this is a case where we're facing this issue for the first time. And, you know, I was unconvinced by Mr. Lewin's argument that your policy must make no sense because Congress says it doesn't, it can't be that we have to defer to your policy because you say it makes sense or that you've always done it this way. I mean, that's the question. And so far from what I've heard from you about why this interferes is, number one, it's the president's judgment that it does. Number two, its longstanding policy. And number three, there was some disruptions at the time of the passage of the bill, right?
And number four, the president's judgment is that this will be understood internationally as
an
act
of
recognition.
Point. That was number one. Yeah, right. So what's the standard we use to look at this? You say in your brief, you use different kinds of words. You say in some place this statute interferes with the recognition power, and elsewhere you say, I think you use encroaches. What do we use? I mean, there must be, you know, obviously there must be some instances when it's de minimis. How do we know that this has crossed the line?
Well, Your Honor, as in Reagan versus Wald, this is the kind of sensitive foreign policy determination that really there should be a lot of deference to the executive branch.
I accept that completely, but what's the standard? How do we know that this is interference or encroachment and not just de minimis? How do I know that?
This is what we put in official government documents. Mm-hmm. So that certainly implicates recognition. Whatever the boundary is on this question, it is not our official government documents, right? That really is the core where we set out United States policy. Now, of course, as you say, there has never been a case like this, but that's because Congress has always acquiesced in the government's, in the executive's recognition decisions, as this court said in its prior opinion in this case, you know, repeatedly and consistently over many years, the Supreme Court has found that the recognition power is a sole executive power. And of course, the fact that it is a sole executive power and that it raises these very, very sensitive questions that we see in the record in terms of the response to this statute when it was passed initially, in spite of the president's attempt at the time to clarify, that really does highlight that this is the kind of decision that does belong within the executive's recognition power.
Is that true of the birth certificate, too?
Yes, Your Honor. With birth certificates, it's the same analysis. Of course, the argument that Congress has...
It can't be the same. I mean, birth certificates aren't... I mean, you make a big deal in your brief that, you know, passports are official documents that introduce people to other countries, right? That's not what a birth certificate does.
Well, a birth certificate is also an official document. Now, when it comes to passports, there's the extra set of arguments. What is Congress's authority, you know, with the scope of the authority over immigration and foreign commerce, and then what is the executive's power as over this document as a communication with foreign sovereigns? So the birth certificate context does not implicate those two arguments, but it is still what we put in our official documents, and that does need to be consistent with the United States policy. You know, Jerusalem, it's such a sensitive question, and we have through...
Excuse me, but see, you're going back. This is interesting because basically you're falling back on your fundamental answer to my question seems to be that this interferes because we have a policy that this violates. That's what you seem to be saying. Your policy is it has to be accurate on official documents. And therefore, this court must defer to that judgment. Right? That's the bottom line for the government's position here.
I do want to also stress that the government has looked at this and found that countries around the world will understand this to be an act of recognition. It's not just our internal law. It's the way it is perceived around the world as well.
And is that true of the birth certificate?
I don't believe the declaration addresses the birth certificate in the same way.
And also, but you don't need, as I understand your argument, it isn't important that there were some international disruptions or demonstrations, right? You would be taking this position even if the enactment of the statute had been greeted by total silence everywhere, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and it would still be our position that this court should defer to the executive's judgment that this would interfere with a recognition decision, but the record in this case does support that judgment.
And what about Mr. Lewin's point that the president is on his way to, his press releases all say he's on his way to Israel and he's visiting Jerusalem?
Your Honor, the president's trip highlights the extreme sensitivity of these questions. I know a number of issues around the president's travel have been discussed at length relating to these recognition decisions. I believe the press release said he's on his way to Israel, the West Bank, and
Jordan.
It didn't say what, it didn't take any position over who has sovereignty over Jerusalem. These are very, very careful.
But you see, his point is he didn't say anything in his press release that he isn't asking to have put on a passport. Israel.
Your Honor, what we're talking about with a passport is putting Israel as the place of birth for people who are born in Jerusalem. And that is contrary to our longstanding policy of not taking any official act that would recognize any state's sovereignty over Jerusalem.
What does the record show why someone born in Tel Aviv doesn't have to have Israel when there's no dispute what country has sovereignty over Tel Aviv?
Your Honor, this is, again, consistent with the general policy applied everywhere in the world, that if you do not like your country of sovereignty as recognized by the United States, you can use the town or the region. It's the same for somebody born in the West Bank that doesn't want West Bank on their passport. They can use the town or the region, or for somebody, as I was saying before, born in Riga, doesn't want to put Latvia on their passport, could put Riga, but they can't put the Soviet Union. This is just that same policy that that you can go down in granularity to get to a town, city, region that you're comfortable with, but you can't put anything on the passport that is inconsistent with U.S. policy and U.S. recognition of.
If I were born in France, could I put Paris? Could I insist that I didn't want France to be on there, but I wanted Paris to be on there?
Yes, Your Honor. And in that case, of course, we would warn you when you got your passport that that might cause problems for you traveling abroad. But yes, you have the option to go down a level of granularity if you dispute that.
Even when the sovereignty isn't in dispute.
Yes, Your Honor, even when the sovereignty is not in dispute, we can go down that level of granularity. That's addressed at 7 FAM 1310 Appendix DG5, as well as, of course, 7 FAM 1383.5-2.
So the bottom line here, the government's position is that statute's unconstitutional because the president, based on consultations, right, with other countries, has concluded that allowing Israel to be on a passport would interfere with his recognition policy, correct? That's it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So one of the briefs says, you know, they lose because the president says they lose, right? That's sort of the position, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, this isn't just the president. As you noted, Congress did understand this statute as setting the policy of the United States with respect to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Congress was trying to interfere with the recognition decision by the executive. But it is the executive's determination, and that determination is, of course, due a great deal of deference.
So suppose none of that language, suppose the title wasn't there. Well, suppose, as Mr. Lewin says, this was just a routine section passed in a passport bill. In other words, it didn't say anything about recognition at all. It just said people born in Jerusalem get a choice. No legislative history, nothing. Different analysis?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so then your position really is limited, right? To this is unconstitutional because the president has determined that it interferes with his recognition power. That's the government's position, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, in evaluating that, of course, there is this long, long history of refusing to take any official act that would recognize any state sovereignty over Jerusalem.
Maybe
there
that
is our
was
consistent-
also unjustified. This is the first time it's been litigated. So what's, given your answer to my question, what's our role? What's the role of this court in reviewing it?
Well, of course.
Do we have any ability to assess the president's statement that this will interfere with his constitutional recognition authority?
Well, of course, this court, as an Article III court, ultimately determines the scope of the Constitution's grant of authority. But the executive's determination is due deference. And in this case, the record does support that this will be seen as an act of recognition, that there was a very strong reaction when the statute
but
was passed.
You told me that none of that was necessary to your argument.
Right, because my argument is that the president has made this determination and that that determination is due a great deal of deference. But if you are uncomfortable with that, the record in this case does support that determination. If there are no further questions, I see that my...
By the way, just one last... I'm just
yes.
curious. What's going on with sub C of this section? The one that denies funds for publications, is that, you know which one I mean? It denies funds for publications that, if a government publication lists governments and capitals, it denies funding for any government publication that doesn't list Israel, Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I know that's not in the case, I'm just curious.
Yes, Your Honor, we haven't implemented that section either.
Okay. I understand.
It's, again, the maps are official government documents.
But it denies funding for it. How do you? Well, never mind. It's not part of this case. I'm just curious about how you don't implement something that Congress has denied funding for. So,
as you say, it's not in this case. We do ask that the court affirm the judgment of dismissal.
All right. Thank you. Does Mr. Lewin have?
I just have a few minutes.
I know you're over your time. Of course you can. Before you start, though, I want to ask. You a question because I went back to see what the Chief Justice said, and he said, resolution of the claim demands careful examination of the textual, structural, and historical evidence put forward by the parties regarding the nature of the statute and of the passport and recognition powers. Now, it seems to me he's lumped together something that sounds like constitutional powers, and we know there's a constitutional recognition power. What do you say is the passport power?
The passport power, we think, is as broad, plenary, as broad as Congress wishes to make it. Starting in 1856, before 1856, there was occasional legislation. But Congress really occupied the field, we think, of authorizing passports, U.S. passports, with a statute in 1856, with a statute in 1926. So we think Congress has total power over how...
To what constitutional power? That's all I'm asking.
Oh, well, pursuant to its immigration power, pursuant to its international commerce, the commerce power, all those. I mean, that's never been challenged. I mean,
I'm just trying.
No, I think that's right. I think there's no specific power in the Constitution that says passports.
Right.
But we think everybody's assumed that pursuant to the power over immigration, over international commerce and things like that, Congress has the power to occupy the field of regulating who may issue U.S. passports and how they are to be issued, what their content is to be, what the fees are to be. All this is within Congress's power. Nobody, I think, has ever questioned that.
Okay.
I wanted to address, first of all, maybe Judge Tatel's questions, in which I think Judge Tatel assumed that the president has done this in consultation with other countries. There's nothing in the record that indicates that. Nothing in the depositions that indicates that the State Department was based on some discussion with other countries and the president made that decision.
I didn't assume anything. That's what the government lawyer told me.
All right. Well, I just want the record to be clear that what appears from the record is this was the State Department's unilateral decision. They may have thought, well, maybe other countries would feel the same way. Some do. Some don't even require or aren't interested in having a place of birth. But nonetheless, this was not a considered international policy that arrived out of some consultations.
So are you implying by that if the president were to be asked specifically, is there going to be a problem putting Israel on passports of U.S. citizens who were born in Jerusalem? The president might say, I don't think it's a problem.
I'm sorry, the president might say,
I don't think it's a problem.
I think that's possible.
No, but I'm asking you, is that the key gap that we have here?
It is a gap. I think even if the president were to say, I think it would be a problem, I don't think that would be sufficient.
But normally, if a power is delegated to an agency and the agency speaks and there's nothing out of the president to the contrary, we go with what the agency has said.
True. But what I was addressing was the question of whether the underlying State Department policy has rational basis and therefore whether Congress could rationally have come to the conclusion it did that this court should enforce. And as I say, I don't think that's our burden because Congress has made that determination, but nonetheless, I think there is a rational basis. It's not that Congress simply acted out of some political expediency which has no ground in reason or in policy.
I mean, as you know, I mean, this court tried to avoid getting into these assessments, and the Supreme Court said we were wrong. So now the implication is, and what Judge Henderson just read from Chief Justice Roberts' decision, is that we are supposed to get into these things. And the court may later tell us we were wrong to do so, but
and we had hoped that the court would get into it 8 years ago, I guess, the first time we were up here.
Yeah.
Or the district court would get into it, and at that point we were told there was no standing, and then this court reversed that. Let me address just a few other very small points. With regard to accuracy and the question of accuracy of the representation, the particular plaintiff in this case was born in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem, in what's called Western Jerusalem. Nobody disputes that from the time Israel was created as a state, that was recognized as part of Israel. And nonetheless, the State Department is saying he may not say Israel in his passport. If we're talking about accuracy, the accuracy is, yes, he was born in Israel, which back in 1948, this hospital was in Israel. And yet the State Department has told him he may not say Israel in his passport. So I don't think the accuracy argument is one that is justified. With regard to what the State Department's policy is or should be, the Taiwan example, which Judge Rogers raised, is a perfect parallel. The State Department said, we're telling the world this is not our policy with regard to Taiwan. Congress has passed the law. People who were born there want to call themselves as born in Taiwan. We are accommodating. And that's the point about the accommodation. Sure, if somebody's born in France, in Paris, and hates the French government, they can, under the regulations, say that they were born in Paris. Very few people do that, but there may be some who do it. But our point is the State Department has recognized that this self-identification is something which should be accommodated to the individual American citizen, and has gone so far as to say that a Palestinian who does not want to say born in Tel Aviv, born in Israel, or I was born in Tel Aviv, can eradicate Israel. Why shouldn't the very same accommodation, if this is an even-handed policy, go to somebody who's Jewish and who's pro-Israel and who's actually born in Israel, born in the Shaarei Tzedek Hospital? If you're accommodating, accommodate both sides. Otherwise, you're discriminating against the side that believes in Israel and thinks that, and is proud of the fact that they were born in Israel. And ultimately, in our, the point is also that the different locations that the State Department recognizes are not recognized sovereigns. West Bank, Gaza, you can put that in your passport. You can say I was born in the West Bank. Somebody born before 1948 can say Palestine. There hasn't been a country called Palestine that has been recognized by the United States. And yet the State Department says, okay, put in West Bank, put in Gaza, put in Palestine. But God forbid, don't put in Israel if you were born in Jerusalem. We think that's improper. Finally, the point in this case, I think, was made, and we've quoted it in our brief by Justice Alito during our argument. He said, is the question whether the president has exclusive jurisdiction, has plenary authority, unreviewable authority, with respect to anything that the president thinks has a bearing on the question of recognition? And Judge Tatel, that's exactly the point that you made. I think that what the State Department is saying is not the substance is what ought to control this, but if the president goes to the court and says, I think that affects my sovereign, my power to recognize foreign sovereigns, I win. Well, that's not true in the immigration area. It's not true in the international tax area. It's not true in any other area. And suddenly they want to do it with regard to passports. Thank you.
I can't let you go, Mr. Lewin, without asking you about a case that you argued about 5 years ago, and that's that Chabad case. And I wonder if you have retrieved the archives, or is it?
That's a very timely question, Your Honor. We were before Judge Lamberth yesterday.
Oh, all right.
And the litigation is going on.
Thank you.
Thank you. You want to take a break?